Welcome to part four of the eight-part podcast on international arbitration featuring Bob Davidson, the head of the JAMS International Arbitration Practice. This part four will deal with pre-hearing conference and scheduling orders.
All right, thank you. Let's talk about these. We're getting into the meat of the arbitration. You've been appointed. The panel has been constituted. You've selected a chair from your other party-appointed arbitrator, or perhaps you've been asked to act as chair of an international arbitral tribunal. And you're sitting there, and what do you do next? All right, the first thing you have to do is schedule a conference with the parties. That can be similar to the domestic procedure. It can be by phone or in person. If it's a large international case, it's often done in person with at least the chair there, and sometimes you've got to travel in order to do that. But so be it. These cases, if they're big enough, the arbitrating parties and counsel will want to meet the arbitrators in the flesh and get a feel as to who they are and what they're likely to do. At least they'll try to read those tea leaves. So the pre-hearing conference and the scheduling order that will come out of that are critical events in an international arbitration as they are in a domestic one. And if you recall the training that we have done at JAMS with respect to domestic cases, you have their forms. You've got the form of questions that you might ask counsel before you even convene the pre-hearing conference so that they can talk to each other and try to resolve any procedural issues without having to discuss them at length and to argue about them at the conference itself. You will have forms of pre-hearing orders which combine not only procedural matters but scheduling as well. And you will have actually a form that's been in the binders of questions which you would ask or at least send to counsel to think about prior to the hearings, which deal with administrative things such as the division of time, how much in advance one party has to tell the other of the order of their witnesses. Third, are witnesses going to be sequestered? Fourth, who are the party reps? You take care of these procedural issues before you get into the room because it'll save an awful lot of hearing time. At the pre-hearing conference and scheduling, I'm saying it carefully because a pre-hearing conference and the pre-hearing and scheduling orders generally are combined into one piece of paper called Procedural Order Number 1. However, there's an important exception. The ICC insists upon something called Terms of Reference and a scheduling order separate and apart from the Terms of Reference. The Terms of Reference is a document which will set forth procedurally the names and addresses of the parties, the arbitrators. It'll recite the arbitration agreement. It will set forth the contentions of each of the parties. It will set forth, and this is important, the issues to be decided in the arbitration. And ultimately, it will be signed by every member of the tribunal and representatives of all of the parties. In international cases, procedure takes a much more significant role than it does in a domestic case. Formal procedural niceties are part and parcel of an international arbitration. So while a scheduling order in the United States might be 4 pages, it might be 12 or 20 pages in an international arbitration proceeding. It will deal with all kinds of things. And there are forms around that can assist you, including the UNCITRAL notes on the conduct of an international arbitration, which are available on the UNCITRAL website and are extremely valuable. But the pre-hearing conference, the terms of reference, The reason the terms of reference are a separate document, and the ICC has had this for years, and people object or complain to it about it, because it takes maybe an additional 2 months of one's life and of the proceeding in order to get these things finalized and signed, and that's if you're lucky. It's because the continental systems insist on strict procedural fairness, which includes a detailed and precise recitation of everyone's claims and contentions and of the relief that each party wants and the issues to be decided. And you'll see on the issues to be decided in the terms of reference, when the award is written, let's say the issues are, did the seller breach the contract for the delivery of goods by the shipment of only two rather than 12 boxes as contended by the buyer? All right, that'll be recited as one of the issues for determination. And in the award, that'll be the heading of the award. You know, did the seller do this, et cetera? It'll recite precisely what's set forth in the terms of reference, and under it will be a discussion and a resolution of that particular issue. So it's very important, the terms of reference, because everybody knows what the deal is, everybody knows what the tribunal is going to decide. The scheduling order under the ICC is separate. Scheduling order used to be under Article 18. I don't know if it's still there now after an additional codification. But the scheduling order will set forth when the hearings are to be conducted, will there be any disclosure allowed, if so, what is the method for doing that, et cetera. And that'll be a separate piece of paper. The ICC has to approve of the form of the terms of reference before they're signed to make sure they are okay. And if they approve, you send it to Paris or wherever the case is being administered. They have an office now in New York City. And you'll get back comments, or they'll say, okay, fine. And you'll have the parties execute. The arbitrators will execute. You have your terms of reference. Similarly with the scheduling order. Once in the ICC rules, the terms of reference and the scheduling order is signed, you're about a third through, believe it or not. That is a major negotiated step, because you'll find each of the lawyers for the parties trying to dodge and weave and jockey a little bit in trying to frame issues in a manner which is favorable to them, and you or your panel will have to make it completely neutral. If you're not under the ICC rules, you will still promulgate a pre-hearing procedure order number one, and that will include not only all the procedures, it will include the scheduling of the case. Very similar to the forms that are used domestically, but often in greater details. You deal with administrative matters, you know, the names and addresses and contact information. You will deal with such things as confidentiality and privacy. Remember, they're two different concepts, if you recall. The proceeding will be confidential by the rules of every institution, but not every institution has them confidential as to the lawyers. The confidentiality obligation is binding only upon the arbitrators in the institution. Internationally, you will very commonly have this confidentiality obligation binding on everybody, including the parties. But you have to deal with that, and if it's not in the rules, you have to ask the parties whether it's going to be confidential. Do they want a stipulation to that effect or an agreement, et cetera? So your pre-hearing order will deal with that. There'll be, of course, the hearing dates and the times, how many days you're going to want to hear this. There will be a discussion about an exchange of documents. Now, in the domestic context, it goes beyond dispute that there's going to be at least talk of a document exchange. In many of these civil rules and the countries that have these civil systems, there's no such thing as disclosure. Just no such thing. If you come out, you're supposed to have the documents which support your case, and if you don't have the documents, you lose. And that's why in Germany, for example, you put in all your pleadings and all your evidence, and the other side can respond, so what? Or you haven't proved anything. By the way, I know there are certain things in the United States, certain claims, well, everywhere, such as fraud claims, fraudulent inducement, things of that nature, which are very difficult to prove without some help from the other side in the form of honest disclosure and or discovery of some sort. But, you know, in these civil law systems, there aren't many fraud claims. The reason is that you haven't got the goods, you haven't got the evidence in front of you ready to do it. There's generally no obligation on the other side to help you out by disclosing some document which is not helpful to their case. So it's not a fait accompli that document disclosure will be allowed. Now, in most of these international arbitrations, the rules provide that it may be provided by the arbitrators at their discretion. And nowadays, most litigants in international arbitration proceedings understand and anticipate there will be at least a basic document exchange. But you have to talk about that. Then, of course, you've got ESI, you've got all the electronic stuff. And if you look at the JAMS discovery protocols, you will find some good rules for limiting electronically stored information and the disclosure of that. And I would recommend those protocols to you. Now, we're talking about witness statements. Witness statements are written statements signed by the witness, usually under oath, that are prepared, and everyone knows they're prepared by the lawyers, but they're reviewed and signed by the witnesses and stand for that witness's direct testimony. These are very common in international arbitration proceedings. They're not nearly as common in domestic U.S. proceedings. They're getting more popular in domestic U.S. proceedings. And in fact, our discovery protocols and our protocols on how to run in arbitration domestically include a statement that the arbitrator should think carefully about suggesting or encouraging written witness statements. In international proceedings, however, that'll be the name of the game. You will almost always get these written witness statements, unless there's some unusual reason why they should be dispensed with. And I'll tell you, they'll be very valuable, because they will allow you, as the arbitrator, to read the direct testimony of all of these witnesses that are going to come before you, and to get a view as to what the merits of the case are before you walk in the room in a way you would not get simply by an exchange of pre-hearing briefs or memos. These witness statements will most likely annex to them documents which the witness refers to, and will basically be similar to that. Remember I was talking about the German proceeding? You'll get all the evidence in front of you before the gavel goes down. And when the witness is called, the witness will be sworn, will be asked whether or not that's his or her witness statement, and whether or not there are any corrections, and sometimes there are. And the witness will swear to the accuracy of the statement. And then maybe after a question or two, just to get the witness relaxed a little bit, the witness will go right into cross-examination. This saves enormous hearing time. It is really eminently fair to both parties. They know what the case is going to be about. There are certain rules that will apply to the cross-examination. One is there will be cross-examination, and in some of these proceedings there's an argument about whether or not cross is appropriate, but of course if someone puts in a direct, they have to be subject to cross, and that's pretty well understood nowadays. There's also a rule that I insist upon, that cross-examination of a witness who has submitted a witness statement is not restricted to the statements in the witness statement. In other words, a lawyer can't narrow the proceeding on purpose by having his witness testify only to topics that the lawyer wishes that witness to testify about. The scope of cross is not limited by the direct. And there are other rules and procedures which go forth on these witness statements, which you will have to become familiar with. But be ready for written witness statements in lieu of direct testimony in most of these international proceedings. Now, experts. Experts in international proceedings are similar to the ones in domestic proceedings. almost always, I've never seen one that did not. There will be written reports by experts, which will be submitted, and then you'll have a chance for rebuttal reports to be submitted. And the one thing that's interesting in international rules, just about universally, including the JAMS International Arbitration Rules, is that the tribunal has the right to appoint its own expert. So suppose you're getting, two contradictory sides to a story, and it's some factual matter that deals perhaps with the tensile strength of some metal or something, you have the right to, as the tribunal has the right, to appoint its own expert report. When that happens, you got to read the rules carefully, because the rules will tell you the method of appointing that expert, what happens in that expert's report, whether both sides are entitled to consult with the expert before or after the report is written. Almost always, the expert has to show up at another hearing and defend his or her opinion through cross-examination and questions by each side. It's a very powerful tool. It is not used very much, but when it is, it's quite critical. Because if you've got, let's say, my example about an argument about the tensile strength of a material, and you have two-party experts disagreeing diametrically, and then you appoint a tribunal expert, you're pretty well stuck with what the tribunal expert tells you is the fact. So in a sense, you are ceding to that expert some of the fact-finding that you would otherwise have to yourself. However, it is well settled. Tribunals can appoint their own experts. Subpoenas. Well, they're called summonses now, at least in the U.S. Context, with the recent report of the New York City Bar Association on summoning arbitrators summoning third-party testimony. However, the subpoenas, how do you get reluctant third parties to testify? Very complicated issue. I know we go through it in the trainings domestically. All I can tell you is that read that report. You'll know what the domestic rule is. With respect to the overseas rule, there is a 28 U.S.C. section 1782 is a statute that says that a U.S. court may assist a foreign tribunal in the gathering of evidence in connection with a foreign proceeding. So if there's a case pending, let's say, in the UK, and there's a third-party witness in the US, maybe the parent of the subsidiary who's the party in the UK, there is an application that can be made to the US District Court in which the parent is located under Section 1782 to subpoena and open up full US discovery in connection with this foreign proceeding. However, most U.S. courts, not all, but most circuits have held that an international arbitration proceeding is not the same thing as a, quote, international tribunal, unquote, under the rule, and therefore 1782 is unavailable to open the door to U.S. discovery in international arbitration proceedings conducted abroad. Very technical. The lawyer's got to read the cases. But that might be something you will have to deal with, because those circuits in which they allow this discovery insist that the tribunal sign the order or indicate in some way that they think that this information is necessary to the determination that they make. Depositions and interrogatories are disfavored in international arbitration. JAMS domestic rules say that both parties, each party gets one deposition and maybe more each as of right, and then maybe more if the arbitrator so determines. There ain't no such thing in international arbitrations unless it's done by stipulation of the parties. So if someone asks for a lot of depositions, there's an easy answer. It's no. Briefs and memorials. In your scheduling order, you will have a schedule for the submission of briefs. Memorial is another word for a brief in an international arbitration proceeding. And usually, this is where the evidence comes in. So you will say on such and such a date, either the parties will exchange, it's either simultaneous or seriatim, you will have a discussion about that. But let's say the claimant will put in its opening memorial and witness statements. And you will get a whole box of material because that's where all the evidence is. You get all the witness statements. You will get the expert reports, which will support the claim. You will get a legal brief or a memorial. And there'll be a certain date when the other side will put in its counter material. There might be a reply. There might be a rejoinder. By the time you get to the hearing, if you've done your homework, you've done a lot of reading, you know this entire case, and you will now listen to the testimony. So briefs and memorials are important, and they will be scheduled in this pre-hearing scheduling order. You might only have one round, or you might have two rounds, up to you. The form of the award. International proceedings will always be reasoned awards. Unreasoned awards are unenforceable in just about every country in the world except the United States. The United States got to the tradition because the American Arbitration Association decided to train their arbitrators to make five-sentence awards. Ain't no such thing in an international proceeding. You will write an award. It will be detailed. There are forms for this. It will be a lot longer, usually a lot longer than a domestic award, because half of it will be procedural. And there are some arbitrators, especially European ones, who will recite every piece of paper they got from the ICC, every email they got from one side or the other, and explain what was done because of that. You don't have to go through that chapter and verse, but your award has to be all-encompassing, go through all the procedure. If it's an ICC case, you will have headings which will match the issues in the terms of reference. You will decide all the issues. And then you will send, if it's the ICC or the ICDR, you will send your award to the provider organization or JAMS. The JAMS International Arbitration Rules have a similar procedure. And the institution will vet the award, not for substance, but for form, will send their comments back. And it is certainly an ICC case, highly likely that you'll be asked to revise certain paragraphs or to include certain things that you have forgotten to include. And that's what a scheduling order is all about. It is a very important event, and once you have done it correctly, the parties have a clear road to where they have to go. You will get very little additional feedback, except if you've got a bunch of U.S. lawyers and who will always ask for more. You know, once the disclosure is complete, there'll be bickering about that, and once you resolve that, some lawyers won't take no for an answer, and you get constant applications which you may have to deny or modify to your liking. And that's it. Thank you.